Yes, my dear friend, if only the teaching of the divine Jesus Christ had been fully respected in its original form, the religion founded upon it with such unprecedented wisdom would not only be the best of all existing religions, but even of all religions that might arise and exist in the future. To return to your Islam, except for the custom of polygamy, it contains nothing which cannot also be found in the Judaic and Christian teachings. The custom of polygamy, established on the basis of the scientific deductions of the Arabian learned being Naulan el-Aul, famous in his time, was introduced into the daily life of people after the founding of the Christian religion. Your religion appeared much later, and it was intentionally restricted by its great founders, who had in mind to lay particular stress on certain everyday customs. They did this because at that time, two facts had become clearly manifest: the decline of the Christian religion and the disappearance in ordinary people of the capacity for contemplation. That is, for the state in which alone the truths indicated in detail by genuine religious teachings can be understood. Having become aware of these facts, the great creators of Islam decided on the one hand to simplify the teaching itself, and on the other hand to emphasize certain customs so that the everyday life of the followers of this new religion, who had lost the capacity for contemplation and consequently the possibility of understanding truths consciously, might flow, even if mechanically, in a more or less tolerable manner. And it was then that, among other customs, they established and laid particular stress on the practices of suniyat, abdast, and polygamy, the beneficial results of which we can see even now. For example, as you have justly observed, thanks to circumcision and ablution, one rarely finds either onanism or certain venereal diseases among the followers of your religion. And thanks to polygamy, the foundation of family life among them rests on reciprocal, so to say, psycho-organic support that is almost entirely absent among the followers of the Christian religion. Of all the useful customs introduced by the great founders of the Christian religion into the life of its followers for the preservation of health and the maintenance of the morality necessary for a happy life, nothing now remains except the custom of periodic fasting, that is, of abstaining at certain times of the year from the consumption of particular edible products. And even this last surviving good custom is either disappearing completely from the ordinary life of the followers of this religion, or it is undergoing such changes year by year that for those who fast, no shock is obtained from its observance, although it was just for that shock that this fast was established. The changes now taking place in this custom of fasting are very characteristic and provide an excellent example of how all the good Christian customs have little by little undergone change until they have finally ceased to exist. An excellent illustration of this is the manner in which this fast is observed at the present day by those called Russian Orthodox Christians. These Russian Orthodox Christians took their religion in its entirety from the Orthodox Greeks, who passed on to them, along with other Christian customs, this same custom of fasting. Among the millions of these Russian Orthodox Christians, the majority still continue to fast, as he said, scrupulously, according to the Orthodox code now existing there. But how they actually perform this ritual of fasting, this can only be described by the apt saying of our dear Mullah Nasir ed-Din: "What does it matter if I sing like a donkey, as long as they call me a nightingale?" It is just the same with the fasting of these Russian Orthodox Christians. As long as they are called Christians, and moreover, Orthodox, what does it matter that they receive no shock whatever from the fast? As I have said, these Russian Orthodox Christians of the present time still observe very strictly all the seasons and days of fast indicated in their code. But as for what should or should not be eaten during a fast, it is just in that question that the left paw of the curly-haired dog of ex-Emperor Wilhelm lies buried. You will understand clearly how these contemporary Russian Orthodox Christians fast if I repeat the exact words of one of them spoken to me not long ago in Russia. I used to meet this Russian there on business and even became somewhat friendly with him and visited him at his house. He was considered by those around him to be a very good Christian and the patriarchal father of a family. He came from the sect of the Old Believers. Old Believers are those Orthodox Christians whose ancestors, several centuries ago, refused to submit to new rules then laid down by somebody or other, and who remained faithful followers of the previous rules, also laid down by somebody or other, only a century or two before this religious schism. And so, one day, when I was dining at the house of this worthy old believer in the company of several other Russians, also Orthodox Christians, he turned to me and said, "Eh, old dear, by the way, I must tell you that the beings of this group have the habit, after the second glass of genuine Russian vodka, of calling their acquaintances by various pet names, such as old dear, my zapapunchik, my pot-bellied beauty, my little brown jug, and so on and so forth." And so this worthy Russian Orthodox Christian, addressing me as old dear, said, "Never mind, old dear, we shall soon be having Lent, and then we shall feast together on genuine Russian dishes. To tell the truth, here in Russia, during meat days, we almost always eat the same things. But during fasts, especially during Lent, it is quite a different story. Not a day goes by, but one is privileged to enjoy the most succulent dishes. You know what, old dear? Just the other day, I made a remarkable discovery on this very subject. This discovery of mine is miles beyond the discovery of that old codger, Copernicus, who, when he was once lying dead drunk on the ground, sensed clearly, it seems, that the earth goes round. You call that a marvelous discovery? In our own mother Moscow alone, hundreds of thousands of such discoveries are probably made every day. No, my discovery is a real one that is highly intelligent and instructive. I discovered that up till now we have all been complete fools and hopeless idiots ever to have imagined and been convinced that for the host of varied and tasty dishes during Lent, we are indebted to the famous art of our chefs and cooks. The day specially blessed for those nearest to me, when I became worthy of understanding this truth, was the day our incomparable Dunyasha finally succeeded in placing within the layers of stuffing in the pies to accompany the Gromwell soup with turbot livers a series of secondary layers. On that day, I understood with my whole being what our mistake had been. First, I understood it myself, and afterward, I proved it to the whole of my household, that if, during fasts, we have such varied and tasty dishes, we are indeed indebted to our blessed and glorious fish alone. During fasts, and especially during Lent, our homes are gladdened by the frequent visits of the most honorable sturgeon and the estimable sterlet and the respected sole and the ever-memorable turbot and Her Serene Highness the salmon and the musical tench and the always supple mackerel and the eternally angry pike, and the sanctimonious carp, and the lively trout, and the superb whitefish, and the proud herring, and that powerful personality, the bream, and all our other benefactors and protectors. When we hear their names, our hearts leap within us. These names of theirs are not just names, but real music. Can one really compare the musical harmonies of various Beethovens and Chopins or other fashionable triflers with the sounds of the names of these blessed fish? Every time we hear the names of these glorious creatures, a feeling of bliss flows within us and courses through our veins and nerves. O blessed fish, ye who were the first to be created by our Creator, have mercy on us and sustain us, even on meat days. Amen. After this prayer, the worthy Orthodox Russian Christian drained a monster glass of genuine refined Russian vodka and stared fondly at a little statue of Venus and Psyche standing nearby. And indeed, my friend, every Russian Orthodox Christian has a more or less similar attitude toward fasting. During these Christian fasts, which came from the Orthodox Greeks, they all eat the flesh of fish. It is not considered a sin for them to eat the flesh of fish, and they eat it heartily as a fast dish. I personally find only one thing incomprehensible. Where did these Russian sorry Orthodox get the idea that during the Christian fasts, especially during Lent, they may eat the flesh of fish? I find this incomprehensible because those Orthodox Christians from whom they took their religion, that is, the Greeks, have never eaten and do not now eat the flesh of fish during fasts. Even today, the Greeks eat fish during Lent only on one day, when, in accordance with the code of the Orthodox Church, they celebrate the memory of a day in the life of the divine Jesus Christ. A fast permitting the consumption of the flesh of fish not only gives no shock at all to those who are fasting, but is even directly contrary to what the divine Jesus Christ intended and taught, and contrary to the purpose of the great creators of the Christian religion in establishing this custom. In confirmation of what I have just told you, my young friend, I will tell you what I once chanced to read about Christian fasting in an ancient Judeo-Essenian manuscript. In this ancient manuscript, it was stated that the custom of fasting at certain times of the year was instituted among the followers of the teaching of Jesus Christ long after his death, that is, in the 214th year after his birth. The custom of fasting was authorized and introduced into the Christian religion by the great secret Council of Kelnuan. This secret Council of Kelnuan was convened by all the followers of the still new teaching of Jesus Christ and was held in the locality of Kelnuk, lying on the shores of the Dead Sea. Hence it is known in the history of the Christian religion as the Council of Kelnuan, and it was held in secret because at that epoch the followers of the teaching of Jesus Christ were ruthlessly persecuted everywhere by the power-possessing people.